Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents Manhattan Phoenix, The Great Fire of 1835 and the Emergence of Modern New York by Daniel S. Levy. Read by Mike Lenz. Preface. The Bowery Theater burns. The fire that started at the Chambers livery stable spread quickly, fueled by bales of hay and whipped up by heavy winds from the west. On that May evening in 1828, the blaze on Bayard Street between the Bowery and Elizabeth Street hopped to nearby buildings, so that by the time firemen like Morris Franklin of the Brass Back Engine Company arrived, a reporter for the New York American noted how the horizon was lighted up with bursts of flames, which were visible from various parts of the city. The Bowery Theater stood nearby. Manager Charles Antonio Guilford had been busy finalizing plans for a festive benefit for his wife, the British actress Agnes Holman Guilford, who was to appear in the tragedy 30 Years or the Life of a Gambler. Yet, as the cast and crew learned of the fire, they fled the building and, along with those living and working in the area, huddled outside as the firemen set up their engines and searched for water to stop the flames. Manhattan lacked a reliable source of fresh water, and the men first found some in a nearby family cistern. It proved too little, though, to save Chambers' livery and its horses. As other fire companies raced to the scene, one of the company's engineers directed the crews. A line was formed, stretching from the foot of Catherine Street to the burning building, and engaging the services of 680 men, recalled fireman Charles Forrester. No fewer than 19 companies snaked their hoses half a mile to the East River. Householders also joined in the work by passing the buckets from hand to hand to fill the engines as the firemen frantically pumped the long-handled brakes to build up pressure to spray the water. While the engine companies drenched the buildings, some of the firemen helped homeowners save their belongings, and those from two hook and ladder companies, which brought the equipment to reach the upper floors, punch holes in walls to vent heat and smoke, and if necessary pull down walls and nearby houses, tried to prevent the blaze from spreading further. As the men worked, wind blew the flames closer to the Bowery Theater. Fearing for the building, the firemen leaned a ladder up against it and started to soak the top of the structure. Designed by the prominent architect and civil engineer Ithiel Towne, the theater boasted 4-foot-thick fireproof brick sidewalls and iron window shutters. This made the actors and crews believe their wardrobes and sets would be safe. They therefore watched in horror as the flames raced up to the pediment and melted the tarred paper and zinc roof, turning the top of the theater into what the New York Evening Post called a pyramid of flame. By then, Franklin had made it up to the Bowery third tier to supervise his men. Someone yelled, "All out!" and they fled. Franklin couldn't find a quick exit and was forced to jump from the balcony to the orchestra level. Bruised and stunned, he groped his way out as firemen pulled the door shut. The roof and the chimneys then crashed in, collapsing the western wall and killing a fireman. Colleagues carried Franklin to a nearby house, but once the foreman caught his breath, he returned to the scene. After 3 hours battling the blaze, the crews finally got it under control. Even so, the once stately Bowery with its towering Doric columns stood a scorched shell, its front cracked and warped, and some 20 other buildings, such as Chambers Livery, Thomas Swift's Porter House, a barber shop, Givens' Stage House and Tavern, Benjamin Scribner's Shakespeare Tavern, and a confectionery shop, all lay in ruins. Afterward, many heaped praise on the firemen. The American noted how, in no part of the world is there a body of men of more zeal, intelligence in their calling, or courage than the New York firemen. Former mayor Philip Hone, who had officiated at the theater's 1826 groundbreaking, came by the following day to look at the site and wrote in his diary, "The conclusion is irresistible that it might have been saved if certain smaller buildings adjoining to it, which were utterly destroyed, had been pulled down in time." Some pointedly criticized the firemen, saying they should have hosed the building more thoroughly before the roof ignited, and called for an inspection of the company's equipment, noting how their elaborately painted engines with the shiny brass hardware seemed to be made more for show than for actual use. The New York Association, a consortium of businessmen, owned the Bowery Theater. Association members, a who's who of prominent New Yorkers in the 1820s, including Henry Astor and James Alexander Hamilton, Alexander Hamilton's fourth child, met the day after the blaze. They resolved that the theater immediately be rebuilt. Guilford had the site cleared and hired architect Joseph Sierra. Peale's Museum and Gallery of the Fine Arts near City Hall, meanwhile, lost no time immortalizing the fire, commissioning two artists to create a mammoth canvas of the scene, which visitors could view for 25 cents. By August 1828, less than 3 months after the fire, workers completed Sarah's redesign, which the press pronounced to be grand and plush. A former Bowery scene painter, Sierra based the new theater on the Temple of Theseus, a sanctuary the Athenians dedicated to the gods Hephaestus and Athena, mythological patrons of the arts and crafts. The New York Mirror wrote that with its faux marble stucco exterior, the structure had a simplicity and grandeur. The marble steps at the entrance led to a portico fronted by six Doric columns and offered access to the theater profuse with ancient Greek motifs. Some 600 gas burners, spaced throughout the house, lit up its crimson cushioned seats and boxes embossed with golden griffins, eagles, and wreaths. The balconies were gilded, the balustrades made from mahogany. The light blue, white, and golden doors were designed to swing both ways to lessen panic in the event of another fire. The Bowery possessed the largest stage in America, and its proscenium arch was painted to look like Parian marble and sported images of Apollo as well as the muses Thalia and Melpomene. Overhead stretched a dome on which was painted a sweeping scene of a woman scattering flowers. The day of the theater's reopening, Philip Hone, who had served as New York's mayor from 1826 to 1827 and kept a diary that is one of the major chronicles of the period, marveled that the immense edifice has been built in the short span of 86 days. To calm its fire-fearing potential patrons, local architects and builders had put an item in the New York Gazette and General Advertiser, letting all know that they had inspected the building and could certify without hesitation that the materials used for the walls, the roof, the support of boxes, the gallery, and every other part of the theater rendered the building in all respects perfectly safe. Then, at the grand opening, the popular Shakespearean actor Edwin Forrest, who had debuted at the theater 2 years earlier and whose feud with the British star William Macready would lead to the deadly 1849 Astor Place riot, recited a poem. Afterward, the audience enjoyed a performance of the prolific British playwright Frederick Reynolds' comedy The Dramatist, and the English-born tightrope walker known as Herr Klein, who was scheduled to perform the day of the fire, displayed his amazing elastic cord show. While the city now had four playhouses, the Bowery, Park, Chatham, and Lafayette, Frances Trollope, mother of British novelist Anthony Trollope, singled out the Bowery, as pretty a theater as I ever entered, perfect as to size and proportion, elegantly decorated, and the scenery and machinery equal to any in London. Owning a theater, however, even one as stylish as the Bowery, could be a brutal business. Jacksonian-era audiences demanded a constantly changing offering of entertainment and were notorious for hurling food and other objects at the actors, as well as fighting amongst themselves. They also regularly trashed theaters. Running a theater was also expensive. Guilford suffered from regular financial woes and died on July 30, 1829, a day after his lease on the Bowery ran out. The New York-born comedian James Hackett briefly oversaw the place. Actor Thomas Hamblin then received a lease and started staging shows in August 1830. Hamblin, who got his start in London playhouses and had arrived in the city 5 years earlier, knew how to cater to a general audience. He put on elaborate melodramas and lively spectacles, including horse and dog exhibitions and shows with elephants. Over the course of the next two decades, during which he owned the Bowery, the British manager bestowed upon his theater a decidedly democratic American tone. Yet, the theater burned three more times during his time there. This, too, proved the fate of Manhattan. For most of the 19th century, the city suffered regular and catastrophic fires. Its lack of a reliable water source, a dearth of construction codes, and at times unruly volunteer fire companies only exacerbated the problem. The threat of fire was especially evident with the outbreak of the Great Fire of 1835, which consumed 674 buildings in the Wall Street District. While destructive, it and other conflagrations allowed for new construction. The city then flourished in the decades leading through the end of the Civil War as builders pushed the settled community northward. As they did, Manhattan metamorphosed from an island of ponds and streams, winding roads, small homes and local markets, to one with wide avenues, lavish mansions, booming industries, and a sprawling Central Park. While its population soared, immigrants streamed in, developers subdivided the land, and buildings like the Bowery, along with thousands of businesses and row houses, rose, then were razed or burned down, only to be quickly replaced by newer, grander ones. Many of the changes to the city came so fast that the city government was unable to handle such basic issues as sanitation, which contributed to the pandemics that periodically ravaged families in crowded tenements and wealthy homes. The arrival of a fresh water supply from Westchester in 1842 did help ameliorate some of this, and also proved essential to combat the fires. But the city's expansion also stoked the power of gangs, and those politicians who called on criminals to help them seize public offices and coffers. Such a grand, whiplash-like transformation should have crippled New York. Residents, though, refused to let turmoil and loss hobble their town. They constantly sought to renew and improve the community, just like the citizens of London would after their great fire in 1666, and those in San Francisco following their devastating earthquake in 1906. While those catastrophes were clearly more destructive than anything that happened in New York, Manhattanites refused to let misfortune stop them. For during these crucial decades, as they quenched blazes, fought over the issues of slavery, and what it meant to be a New Yorker and an American, the city's inhabitants, both rich and poor, native-born and newly arrived, turned their island city into the nation's commercial, financial, and cultural center. For like the phoenix, a mythical bird which consumes itself in flames and from its ashes springs anew, Manhattan would each time emerge refreshed and stronger following its fires, its plagues, its riots, as its development pushed farther up the island. And more importantly, the changes that took place in those years set the stage for even bigger ones a half century later. It made possible the 1898 consolidation of Manhattan, the Bronx, Brooklyn, Queens, and Staten Island, and the creation of what we today know as Greater New York. Manhattan Phoenix is the story of New York during the first half of the 1800s. It explores the Great Fire of 1835 and its effect on the city, told through a number of subjects such as fire, land development, culture, water, abolitionism, and politics that will progress chronologically through the book. At the same time, it will follow the lives of New Yorkers who helped tell the story. Those like Philip Hone, the lawyer George Templeton Strong, the restaurateur Thomas Downing, Mayor Fernando Wood, and Central Park designer Frederick Law Olmsted, along with the impresario Thomas Hamlin, his Bowery Theater, and its proud and often unruly audience. 19th century New York is a city that both embodied America and, in some ways, transcended it. A place unlike anything else in the United States. This is a tale of how the famous as well as the forgotten inhabitants of this once provincial center on the eastern seaboard, turn their restive community into a dynamic world metropolis. Introduction. 1825 to 1835, one of the greatest commercial towns in the world. On January 7, 1825, 3 years before the Bowery Theater fire, and just over a decade before the fire that began New York's Renaissance, investors gathered around the fireplace at the Tontine Coffee House, located on the northwest corner of Wall Street and Water Street. They gazed at the glowing firebox and saw firsthand the advantages of the anthracite coal shipped in from northern Pennsylvania, about which they had read in such papers as the New York American. The press had lauded the rich mines, and promoters were trying to interest those gathered in their product, explaining how they planned to ship the slow-burning and low-smoking coal to Manhattan by way of a new canal, one that would run from Pennsylvania to the Hudson River. Most of all, they stressed the vast profits investors could make. Maurice and William Wirtz, the promoters in question, had long dreamed of this stock offering day. The dry goods merchants laid the groundwork for their Delaware and Hudson Canal Company. Garnering the support of DeWitt Clinton, the canal advocating New York governor, whose Erie Canal was nearing completion. In the early 1820s, the brothers had also convinced Philip Hone of the wisdom of their scheme, and the retired auctioneer and well-connected future mayor helped form the firm. In March 1823, the Pennsylvania legislature approved the Wirtz proposal to canalize the Lackawaxen River, and the following month, New York's legislature incorporated the Delaware and Hudson. The advertisements and the articles by the press moved things along. People quickly scooped up the $100 shares for what was to be the first privately built canal in the United States. Hone himself handed over $3,360 as first payment on 672 shares of stock. In just a few hours on the 7th, investors had bought all $1.5 million worth of shares. In March, officers gathered again at Tontine and made Hone president. They had convinced Benjamin Wright to take the position of principal engineer. The Connecticut-born Wright was then completing the Erie Canal. In March, he dispatched John Bloomfield Jervis, who had worked on the Erie Canal, to survey the area near their mine, and then planned a 32-foot-wide canal to run along the banks of the Delaware and the Lackawaxen Rivers, and then to the Hudson River. At the July 13th groundbreaking, which took place in the Catskills town of Mamakating, located in the southeast part of Sullivan County, Hone turned the first shovel full of dirt, telling the crowd that while the canal might be small compared to the Erie Canal, it would benefit the products of your own farms and the timber of your own forests. As with the stock, things move fast. In December 1828, 10 canal boats filled with coal left the newly found community of Honesdale, named in Hone's honor, and today the county seat of Wayne County, Pennsylvania, for a 108-mile ride to New York City. The coal sold well, the company prospered, and Hone, whose opinion was highly respected around town, helped promote the product, lending his name to an ad for Pierce's kitchen range and cooking apparatus, which had been adapted to use Lackawanna coal and was now installed in his own kitchen, which I approve of very highly and recommend to public patronage. The canal was part of the burgeoning of trade that followed the end of the War of 1812, a time called the Era of Good Feelings, when the new republic was entering a period of domestic tranquility that saw an expanding international trade. Canals, as well as ports, steamboats, and roads, were seen as essential for the growth of the nation, which, in 1816, only had 100 miles of man-made waterways. Canals rapidly became big business. Besides the Delaware and Hudson and the Erie, numerous others, such as the Champlain, 1823, and Morris, 1831, crisscrossed the land. By 1840, the nation could claim 3,000 miles of canals. None of these waterways, though, could compete with the audacious scale of the Erie Canal. Early on, Clinton seized on the idea of a grand path to the West that would turn New York into the world's greatest commercial emporium. When the 338-mile-long canal opened in 1825, Hone, along with Alderman Henry Wyckoff, headed to Albany to invite dignitaries to Manhattan for a gala celebration. As part of the festivities, Clinton and others boarded the Seneca Chief for a trip down the canal to the Hudson River. When the boat arrived downriver in New York on November 4th, they came upon a 3-mile-wide flotilla made up of steamboats, visiting British warships, and vessels filled with dignitaries and ordinary citizens. Guns fired salutes. Those on the shore and rooftops cheered. At the Narrows, the mile-wide waterway that leads from New York Harbor into the Atlantic Ocean, Clinton sanctified the wedding of the waters by pouring in 2 casks of Lake Erie water, while others added waters from the Mississippi, the Amazon, and the Danube. The group then headed back to the Battery, a park located at the tip of Manhattan, for a grand parade. 100,000 people in a city of 166,000 came out for the occasion. That night, thousands feasted at a dinner at the Lafayette Theater and gazed at the fireworks lighting up the sky. The Erie Canal's success proved Clinton's prescience. Within a year of the wedding of the waters, shipping costs from Lake Erie to the city dropped from $100 a ton to $9. 500 trade and commercial businesses opened in the city in 1825, including textile factories, sawmills, and ironworks. Soon, the annual value of material passing through hit $15 million. Businessmen were flocking to New York. New York was well on its way to establishing a transportation network that gave it both access and financial dominance over the nation. Besides canals allowing trade with states as far away as western Ohio, roads connected it to the hinterlands, railroad lines were laid and trains started to roll into town, and sloops and steamboats slipped up and down the East Coast, along the Hudson and East Rivers, as well as through an intricate network of rivers, inlets, and bays. The city's manufactured goods headed west and south, while southern and western farm produce flowed to Manhattan. Dock workers, meanwhile, kept busy transferring southern cotton and wheat to Europe-bound ships. The vessels came back with finished British and continental goods. The city had already taken the lead in the China trade, with merchants like John Jacob Astor making a fortune by sending ships with furs and opium to Asia, then returning with silk, porcelain, tea, and ivory. There was, likewise, a growing trade with Central and South America, as shippers packed outbound vessels with flour, textiles, and machinery, and brought back coffee and hides. Not surprisingly, the city had become the nation's center of shipbuilding. Shipwrights, blacksmiths, and caulkers turned out barks, fishing schooners, and Whitehalls, with shipyards launching 19% of the nation's ships, barks, and brigs in 1831. New York's location made all this possible. In the 1820s, the city was just on Manhattan Island. The settled part of town stretched up to around 14th Street. To the north were hamlets, villages, and communities, such as Bloomingdale, Harlem, Harsonville, Manhattanville, and Yorkville. With its sprawling harbor and river system, it was developing in just the right spot on the eastern seaboard. When novelist James Fenimore Cooper moved down from upstate New York to New York in 1822, he noted how it is only necessary to sit down with a minute map of the country before you to perceive, at a glance, that nature herself has intended the island of Manhattan for the site of one of the greatest commercial towns in the world. He announced that the hour of this supremacy has arrived. With so much arriving on ships, one arena in which fortunes could be made was in auctioning. As stevedores unloaded goods, auctioneers took out ads, displayed the merchandise, and held sales. Auctions handled 10% of goods in 1818. The number more than doubled and reached 26% in 1826. The auction business had turned Hone into a wealthy man and allowed him to become an active leader in the social and political life of his hometown. Born on October 25, 1780, Hone came from modest German-French stock. His father, Philip Sr., and mother, Hester, owned a small wooden house on Dutch and John Streets. Philip Sr. worked as a carpenter, advertising in the New York Gazette and the Weekly Mercury all kinds of Albany boards and plank, oak and Jersey pine timber of all sorts, the best 3 feet or long shingles, lath, etc. The couple had 12 children, though just four, Judith, John, Samuel, and Philip Jr., lived into adulthood. By age 17, Philip joined his older brother John's new auction house, which initially stood on Pearl Street and soon moved to Wall Street. Hone learned fast and soon became a consummate auctioneer. A tall, spare man with a shock of curly hair, a strong jaw, and a commanding voice, he handled whatever the auction house needed him to do. He inspected consignments, filled out invoices, and sold everything from India lute strings, satins, beaver pelts, British textiles, and French paintings, to Hyson green tea from China, New Jersey cornmeal, stretches of land in Onondaga County, and even a 150-ton brig called Anna Maria. At the start of 1800, Hone became a partner of the newly christened John and Philip Hone Auction House. In October 1801, the 21-year-old merchant married 23-year-old Catherine Dunscombe, the daughter of Daniel and Margaret Dunscombe. Their business enjoyed a large clientele, and among them was Astor, with whom Hone formed a lifelong friendship. In 1815, the house netted $159,007 in profit, with Hone receiving $55,652. The prominent merchant, Nathaniel T. Hubbard, recalled how Hone's firm became widely known throughout this city for their honesty, industry, and integrity. As New York grew, Hone joined numerous business ventures. He sat on the first board of directors of the Bank of America and served as a director of the National Insurance Company. He became a director of the Eagle Fire Company of New York in 1811, an early fire insurance firm. In 1818, he dabbled in the ferrying business, running horse-powered team boats to Hoboken, New Jersey. He helped found the Bank for Savings. Along with his brother John and an associate named Peter Schenck, he formed a company to build the Matiawan and Glenham Companies in Dutchess County to make woolen goods. The venture was joined by Astor and others. By the time Hone retired from the auction business in 1821, his net worth was $500,000, a staggering sum at the time. He decided to travel, heading out for a grand tour of Europe. He attended the July 1821 coronation of George IV in London, visited cathedrals and museums throughout the continent, and started to collect art. When Hone returned home, he bought a four-story Federal-style home at 235 Broadway that stood opposite the nine-acre spot simply known by New Yorkers as the Park. This open space around City Hall stretched from St. Paul's Chapel to Chambers Street, and at its southern end rose a marble gateway. The area contained a massive fountain. Hone's was one of the city's finest row houses, with a slant roof and dormers and a cistern in the yard for rainwater. The home was outfitted with wainscoting, sliding mahogany doors, large sideboards, and huge mirrors. And Hone filled it with art, statues, cut glass, porcelain, and other collectibles. Merchant John Pintard observed how the home allowed Hone to live in the genteelest style of any man in our city. While Hone stopped working, he kept busy. He doted on Catherine and their large family, three sons, John, Robert, and Philip Jr., and three daughters, Catherine, Mary, and Margaret. His wife, Catherine, was a homebody who rarely went out, but Hone took his children to openings, dinner parties, the theater, and events around town, and set up his sons in assorted business. He also belonged to and founded a slew of social entities, such civic organizations as the Mercantile Library, served as a vestryman for Trinity Church.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?